Thursday night. It's 10 p.m. And you're listening to the news. I'm TC Downey. With me on the air is Jeanette. Jeanette, how are you this evening?
I'm good.
There? Yeah, you still laughing at your husband over there?
Yeah. I was telling him your idea, and then he said, no, don't do that. Use corn syrup, dark corn syrup. And then he's like running through it. I was like, so it's like, okay. Sounds like Forrest Gump over here about fake blood, basically.
Right on. What would be the point of using corn syrup, if I can just inquire?
Well, he was saying that using theatrical blood would be better because it would show up better on film of some kind and that it has a corn syrup base.
Oh, I see. Honestly, I think I would be happier with the natural-looking blood. It doesn't need to be as dramatic as one might think to really make the suggestion that I need. But you know, you always can do it again if it doesn't work. So I definitely keep that in the bag.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah.
So before we get going tonight, I kind of wanted to stop and make a little bit of a commentary. I caught your recent blog, The Art of Being a Bitch. I thought it was entertaining at the same time, honest and insightful. And I mean, I really enjoyed it. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Thanks. No, that was, yeah. Well, last week I told you that was my New Year's resolution. That didn't work out very well at all. I don't know. Yeah, I was like, ugh. Yeah, and my whole life, yeah. It's at least for me, I was rather, and that's the main reason why I wrote it, was because, you know, sometimes people think that something that's just innately who they are is some kind of character defect, and that sometimes comes from other people telling you that behavior is inappropriate.
Right. Well, I mean, if it's something that's innately you, it's certainly not a character defect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I also roasted myself this week. That's the one I was the proudest of, actually. That was harder to do than it seemed, actually. I was like...
Right on.
Yeah.
So, anyway, got me to thinking after I read that blog about what we might discuss tonight.
Yeah.
Well, there has been this trend lately amongst our hardcore pragmatists that hang out on a Sin forum where, you know, they do a lot of talking, and I made a bunch of notes, so give me a second to just kind of pull them up. But yeah, I really respect these guys, and they talk up action quite a bit, and I really believe that they take action, and I really believe that you know, what they're trying to do is something that's worthy of consideration. I mean, this is how, in essence, we kind of come to understand who we are by doing these kind of things. You know, like you figuring out by making a resolution that, wait a minute, this is just who I am. You know, that in itself is what one might refer to as esotericism. Or esotericism, however you want to say it. And I thought that tonight we might talk for a bit about why we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, why we shouldn't just completely starkly abandon the idea of esoteric learning. The thing about esoteric learning, the thing about taking action is you most certainly do gain insight or knowledge through taking action. That's actually where the knowledge is drawn from when you're practicing some form of, I don't know, esoteric dogma or whatever it is. If you have some esoteric approach to what you're doing, you're not actually acquiring the knowledge until you put the rubber to the road, so to speak. And if I kind of stop at weird points, it's because I'm shoveling nachos in my mouth and drinking this Margaritaville spiked iced tea. And so I'm also trying to follow my notes at the same time. But anyway, this is one of the things that really kind of fascinated me early on with the writings from Anton Long, was that he was working off of the idea that by taking your philosophy and putting it into action, that you ultimately end up with, you know, an understanding of what you're really made out of. You know, that the whole sevenfold way, it kind of, the way that it breaks down, or at least as I understand it in its most primitive form, is that it's meant to test your mind, it's meant to test your body, and it's meant to test the soul, so to speak, or your emotional presence. If you can withstand any of these tests or all of these tests in some sequence, when you walk away from this series of tests, you will have gained quite a great deal of understanding in who you are and what you are made of. And that really is the whole purpose of any kind of esoteric practice, is to come away with an understanding of who you are. I got more.
I certainly agree with you, and I think that that's, at least for me, that's, I don't know, it's really the most important thing for me. It's not how I think about it, but how do I apply it? Like, you know, I at least still, I don't know how to explain it. Like, when it comes to mind space, I am pretty sure, like, if you ask me to explain how do you feel about blank, 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 and blank, so to speak, I could say, well, it's this. You know, and things that have, but, and that's become a point of application, because I want to test, basically. It's like in my head I have my theoreticals, and I'd like to see if it applies when it actually happens. I try to, and it's a little bit of having been into Crowley, where he kind of approached magic from a more, He always tried to view it as a science, which is that you kind of write out what you think will happen, and then once it's done, you can determine, you know, what you did wrong, how it works. And I do actually try to approach this the same way, which is like, if I feel this way about this, when I start doing it, you know, what happens, and how off was I from what I thought that I would actually, you know, experience from it. I mean, like, a little one would be working out, which is that I've been doing this now for a couple years. I am so proud of the progress I've made with my body and all this, but I have yet to be thrilled about working out. I have yet to not have my brain try to convince me that I don't have to do it for a thousand and one different reasons. And I always thought that would go away. You know, like if you'd ask me, like, well, eventually I'll enjoy it. It's never happened.
Right. I mean, I absolutely see what you're saying here, and I don't find any fault in it. It's actually kind of funny that you bring up the idea of working out, because that in itself was kind of something that I had in mind to sort of talk about a little bit tonight, and that is that something that makes working out actually somewhat enjoyable, but not necessarily, I mean, to the point where you're going to say to yourself, oh, I really do enjoy it. But what you do is you learn techniques, and you learn different processes to do certain things. I mean, then there are particular exercises that strengthen, there are, or refine or define, however you want to put it, different regions of your body. And if you culminate them all correctly, if you work with them all correctly, in the end of it, you can find yourself very much in the exact shape that you imagine. But it's because there is this technique if you were to just go out and try to bench press school buses all day for the rest of your life, what you would probably end up with is like this Popeye the Sailor Man style forearm and chest muscles and shoulder muscles, but you'd have very scrawny legs and probably a flabby waist, and you would not have really gained that whatever shape it was that you were going for, unless you happened to be going for that. But I don't think very many people want to look so top heavy.
Yeah, well, and the other thing with working out too, at least, is that you have to switch it up. Like, you can't keep doing the same thing, because eventually the muscles become used to doing that same action, and it starts becoming more and more worthless to do over time. Like, you either have to add weight or you have to change basically the way that you're doing it, which also is interesting, because at least for me, like, something that, like, I didn't dig at all before, I do find fascinating, because literally it's always got to constantly be changing. And at least for me, like, you always have to set a new goal, or, you know, I have to have a goal, or I'm just not going to, I'll just stop doing it, because I'll have achieved my goal, basically. I'll just, like, you know, stop. So, yeah, no, that's the other thing. And it's, at least for me, it's a really important part of my, it is, in a way, philosophical for me, like, being in really good physical shape. I'm a big believer that, you know, I got it a long time ago from the idea of the spiritual mimicking the physical. And I thought
right.
to myself, sort of like, well, who you think you are in your mind, then you need to figure out how to manifest, how to make yourself that, you know, in the world as you operate. So, like, if I basically in my head, I think I'm being a warrior princess, so to speak, that's my goal.
Right. Well, here's the thing. Absolutely everything that you just said was right on the money. And I hate to sound like somebody that's just agreeing to agree, but that's not the case at all. The first thing that I want to point out is that we made specific mention that you have to do different exercises. If you do the same exercise, it becomes mechanical, it becomes repetitive, and then our physiology equates it to something that it must adjust to over long term. It streams it down to the most efficient process, and it continues to do it. So where you may have gained, I don't know, 16 inches in total roundness of your shoulders, if you do the same exercises for long enough, what you'll actually begin to find is not a stabilization or a increase any longer, but over a long period of time, a decrease, because your muscles themselves are getting into the most efficient shape that they can. And this works the same from all aspects. The idea, the mind, the body, the soul, those three different things, they all need to be worked on simultaneously. And in the same manner as each one is. I'm sorry, I'll let you go. I scoop up the last of my nachos here into my mouth. So.
Oh, no, yeah, no, that's I definitely agree, which is that, you know, that's actually why I'm sort of trying to, that's why I've been sort of stepping away from Satanism at the moment, is because I'm trying to exercise my philosophical muscle, so to speak, in other areas, because, you know, I don't want to get, you know, I don't want to become dependent on any one, you know, ideology, so to speak, to sort of define what I think. And that's a, you know, but at the same time, it's sort of hard, because, like, at least for me now, like, I have noticed, especially recently, that I have a real difficulty sort of separating, like, if I'm doing something else, like, I still view it through that lens.
Right on. Well, another person that really inspires me that has written in the past is Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff understood that these three aspects of yourself, your mind, your body, and your emotions is actually what he kind of tied it down to. Now, I say soul because most people think of soul in that aspect. They think of soul as being an emotional presence. I mean, I don't know if you realize that, but that you're innately conditioned to think of it that way just because of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Gurdjieff also had a seven-system plan. And his seven-system plan was much more cleverly hidden within a thing that he called the Law of Octaves. The thing about the Law of Octaves is that he never outright comes out and tells you what each level, each set of tests are in this Law of Octaves, and rightly so, as you would see demonstrated in the Enneagram, which is the sacred symbol that he brought back with him. They're all interconnected, and they're all infinite. Because they're interconnected, they just cycle, they circle, but they don't circle in some kind of logical succession. Each one can move to the next one fairly freely, only needing to pass by one or two of the other ones in order to actually work itself into whatever it is. And he gives some hints to what each level's tests are, and he does so through his piano example, in which he explains that all things are on different levels, like notes on a scale. He goes further by painting out what he calls the ray of creation. His ray of creation, it bounces from, you know, the microcosm to what we would refer to as the macrocosm, but he calls the macrocosm something else. It's much further out. But he calls this, the earthly realm, or the realm of man. And then there's this worldly level. Then there is a planetary level. And that planetary level, obviously, is like the solar system or whatever. And then keeps going out and dialing up, and each time it gets bigger. And what he does is point out that you can look at things that have happened in each one of these levels, and you can see some kind of demonstration of a resonance. They're not exactly similar, but they're suggestive of each other. One example I've used a few times now is the idea of the comet crashing into the planet, and then the planet, then beginning to form life. Well, if you dial that down to a smaller scale level, what you run across is the idea of the egg and the sperm. And now you have, once again, a comet crashing into a planet or a sphere and life beginning. So you see there's this repeating pattern that is echoing on each level. And if you look hard enough, you can find resemblances on each level that Gurdjieff describes. And the reason that he describes these things is to get us thinking about the fact that as we're working, as we're moving towards things, we need not just be mindful of our own physicality. And by physicality, I'm just kind of bunching together those three different principles, you know, mind, body, soul, mind, body, emotions, whatever. But you need to be focusing on what's actually happening in the material realm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to go just kind of somewhat beyond that, he begins kind of actually talking about the fact that this natural cycle, which he calls the ray of creation, again, I'll reiterate, it's very suggestive of the Vedic gods, which me and Lehi have done some covering of in the Saturday's Primus Mano editions. Brahma, the creator, Vishnu, the stabilizer, and Shiva, the destroyer. So what you now have is another representation, another level that's intertwined, interconnected. The mind is a creative element. The body, it's a sustaining element. And our emotions, well, they're the destroyers. They're what break all of these different lines and paradigms and barriers and icons. The emotional field is very destructive in general. Now, of course, each always leads into the other. And so because each always leads into the other, you can look at something that has been destroyed and at the same time view it as something that is being reborn right in front of you again. So I suppose to kind of wrap this back around and get back into why it is that I'm talking about these sorts of things is because taking action without having some kind of technique practice and put into place, it becomes kind of futile. I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried to put the damn candies into a Pez dispenser, but if you don't do it just right, you got candy shooting all over the fucking place. So, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I've done that before. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I think when it comes to, action and what to do, I do think that's kind of, I think that it's, I don't know, I find that it's a very strange place to be in because, like, at least for me, it's, nobody else's ideas of what to do to get there really, work for me or my life or anything else, but I am still interested in pursuing a set of things to get to a certain place. And, it seems to me at least that a lot of times not following a program, so to speak, or a certain way tends to be a justification for doing nothing, or doing the bare minimum to get by, but at the same time, that the other difficulty is that when you start bringing it down to your own individual person, sometimes I don't think that other people's plans work at all.
Right, which is exactly why Gurdjieff never really tells you exactly how to work the seven, the law of octaves, the law of sevens. The reason that he does this is because the work ultimately it is working, and by working, what it means is that you will need different exercises to achieve different results, and those exercises are not to be formulated by exterior influences, but to be developed through interior influences, through maybe seeing what has done before and seeing what results have come about and putting different things into practice for a short period in time to see what works for you. But ultimately, in the end of it all, what you come up with that truly will work for you will be a hodgepodge of all these different things that you've looked into trying to correct this one thing. So you might borrow steps 6 through 12 to kick your alcohol addiction, but, you use the Pythagorean theorem to handle 1 through 6, and the two don't seem related, but somehow in your mind you've justified it to giving you the results that you need, and you've tried it, and it's true.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is that, I've read some on Gurdjieff. It was one of the things that I actually really appreciated about him was something where he said, nobody else can tell you what the way is and that the way is different for each person. I was like, that's actually really cool, that he says, this is definitely individual and personal for each person that takes this up.
Right, and this is where some of the other would-be fourth-way experts out there that are trying to dogmatize what was taught, I mean, from Maurice Nicol down to Ouspensky and all these other, Achovy or whatever the dude's name was, they're all trying to dogmatize something that was meant to be very organic. And they fail miserably because of it. Because what happens with anything that forms a system, people figure out what the loopholes are to that system. People figure out how to use it and take advantage of it. Anytime something becomes predictable, we now have the ability to learn how to manipulate it. Once you can see a pattern, once you can see it develop, and you understand what comes next, if something happens, well, all of a sudden you know to do this or that, and this or that will happen. To give you a good example, I saw a documentary not too long ago on, I don't know, some documentary site that Mickey likes to go to. And what they did was they roughly took about 200 pounds of gunpowder and they leveled the side of a 150-foot mountain using it. Now, 200 pounds of gunpowder, if it was all set into one place, lit and exploded, would have barely made a crater in the side of it. But what they did was they drilled holes according to the texture of the surface of it and filled a certain amount of gunpowder into each place. And they lit it, and they used the fact that the actual force comes from something, I'm trying to remember, with shockwave, that's the word I was looking for. Actual force comes from something that we cannot really see but is predictable, and that is the shockwave. I mean, if you slow film down and you really take a look, you can see shockwaves, and then you begin to understand that if you time it just right, if you start one shockwave just as another is reaching its max potential, that you create more force in this way. And I'm trying to remember why I brought up this example, except for that the succession, the experience and understanding of how the system is actually going off and how things are achieved within this system gives us the ability to manipulate it. This is, for all intents and purposes, what we in the West have been deeming magic since day one.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that ability.
Mm-hmm. So, oh yeah, I mean, like, you see it, you know, everywhere. This kind of, you know, somebody else has set it out, and this is what I'm going to do. And then, like, you know, they know what the results are going to be. It's you know, because other people have talked about it or whatever. So then, you know, when it turns out exactly the same way, it's sort of, you know. I, at least for me, it's like, well, you didn't really discover that for yourself. You just did what everybody else did and then came to the same conclusion they did, which is sort of, you know, that's not really, I don't know, in a way that's not, I don't know how to explain it. My mind just went blank. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. And you're actually onto something, definitely, because we can repeat things like this. And as we realize that it is demonstrable, that we can repeatedly demonstrate it. It loses its mystique, it loses its magical appeal, it loses its value inherently, and becomes just another system that we can manipulate. I mean, let's face it, the human organism is good at one thing and one thing only, and that is manipulating the systems that it finds. I mean, ultimately, that is why we have come as far as we have, because we know how to manipulate. But
oh, yeah, no, I would certainly agree. I also think that human beings are inherently lazy and want to try to find the way to expend the least energy to do the most, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, except when, you know, like, I don't know, especially in, like, the environment that, you know, we live in the West, where it's very easy to expend no energy to get pretty much everything you want.
Right on. And I mean, that ultimately is the case. On the one side of the coin, this looks like a very positive thing. This looks like what we want. You know, it's gonna make things go good. I mean, we're taught work smarter, not harder. We're taught, you know, to kind of feel, you know, things as they go. But ultimately, in the end, for us to really take away anything about what it is that we've learned, for us to really come up with something other than just another practice or system put into place, we have to slow ourselves down and take a look at what we're doing and figure out what works for us. A good example is this past week in my apprenticeship, I've been working on making these really awesome lines. And the ultimate goal is to be able to do permanent eyeliner on women and have it look sharp forever. So I could draw a really straight line with a tattoo gun, not a problem. I can fill in the curve, not a problem. But in the end, what I was coming up with is every time I did it, it would look almost perfect, but never be exactly what I wanted it to be, because I was trying to replicate step by step exactly what I was showing. The problem is, I'm a different person. And so what I ended up doing was just slightly augmenting the system that I was given and making it fit my habits and customizing it so that I could utilize it and draw from that pool of working knowledge versus theoretical or technical knowledge. So in the end, anyways, I've gotten now to where I can draw that perfectly straight line and do my little fill-in without having to actually go through the process. And every time I do it, it comes out exactly how I envisioned it.
Yeah, no, No, exactly. It's like what you said. It's got to be personal on some level and take into account your own personal stuff, you know, in order for it to really work effectively. I've had that in, like, jobs I've worked in the past where, like, they've got a very specific, like, Waffle House, for example, has a very, very specific set. They call it the 10 set. And it's basically from beginning to end what you do with a customer, you know, from the time they come into the door till the time they leave. Now, most of the girls there actually didn't follow it at all. Like, they just ignored it and threw it out the window. Now, I, like, memorized it because you had to, and I was a certified immediate trainer and trained other waitresses and stuff. But the only way that I effectively worked it was pretty much like it was almost like a script. Like, you had to say, you know, a certain thing, you know, at each step, so to speak. Well, it didn't really work, like, when I first started and I was using it exactly and using their script. And I realized what it was later is that it sounded automated because I'm reading a script. Yeah, once I threw that script out the window and pretty much went with, you know, my own personal version of, you know, hello, welcome to Waffle House, what can I get for you today, you know, which was actually like, yeah, that was sort of what I wound up on. It was more like, hey, y'all, how you doing? You know, I changed it to my own thing. Well, then, like, my money doubled instantly just based off of, you know, tweaking it to be my own thing and, like, basically throwing out their scripts while still following the same exact formula they were talking about.
Exactly. And I think that the important thing here that we're learning is that obviously we want some level of efficiency. Otherwise, we wouldn't develop these systems like we do. We all recognize that there's a certain level of peril in just going out there and randomly doing things. We accomplished a lot of nothing in every which direction, and in the end, you end up frustrated and tired. So, you know, there's got to be a fine line between, you know, being an actor and creating this false facade and ultimately, you know, being completely loose and free and, I don't know, creating nothing at all, that there's that fine line that sets between. And I kind of want to, you know, use another example if I can. Often when people are whittling, you know, it's a very creative thing. It's a very intuitive thing. You know, you sink your knife in and you take out a little chunk, and as you take out that chunk, you try to imagine what the next chunk is that you'll need to take out to, you know, begin to make the shape that you want. And as you're moving away these pieces, you find that they're different sizes, they're different shapes. Each one has been custom fit to what you had in mind in achieving. And, I mean, the replication factor may not be as easy, but the authenticity and the true beauty of it is intact and it's there. So I would say that whittling in itself is a good example of how to live in a more organic fashion and, you know, use, draw from these esoteric things as you're taking action to really build a working physical knowledge versus some theoretic application or, you know, just some blind grunt force.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I mean, that's the main thing is that, you know, I, at least, you know, you read around and, you know, you meet people and stuff and, you know, like, you notice there's kind of a, if there's no system in place, they're not doing anything really but basically talking or, you know, it's sort of a, you know, it's all in their head, which is, you know, an issue, you know, if you subscribe to any ideology basically of any sort. I mean, like, you know, I see that with people I know that I call them theoretical Christians, which is that, you know, they go to church and they read the book and they're basically doing what Daddy did, but at the end of the day, there's no real application of what they're supposed to be doing whatsoever, even down to, you know, like a, here's an example. It's just, it's a small example, but it's an example of what I'm talking about. Like my husband's family, they're Seventh-day Adventist, and they're not supposed to use salt or pepper. It's like a big deal, like seasonings. I don't know. It's a weird thing. But pepper is stimulating. That seasonings are stimulating, and you shouldn't be so stimulated. But the amount of people that subscribe to Seventh-day Adventism that don't do that are, like, very, very, very few. You know, when, like, I can say, like, this is the world's most retarded thing, but, you know, if you're going to put that label on yourself, then you should not be seasoning your food, right?
I hear you, but I don't think the label itself is the issue. And the label itself doesn't force you to adhere to the particular dogma. It's your own idea of trying to replicate something that's fictitious. That's forcing the idea. You know,
yeah.
You could subscribe fully to this, but pepper the shit out of your food. You know, and you may take something completely different from this. Sometimes heretical actions, heretical, oh my God, I'm having a little bit of a tongue twist here, don't mind me. Sometimes those actions in themselves work themselves into a dogma of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Someone
yeah.
does something heretical, and they find a great deal of value in it, and other people look at it, and they try to emulate it, and they themselves then draw a great deal of value from it. And over time, well, that this works better than that, so let's just go ahead and annex this and ixnay that, and the cycle begins again. Now,
yeah.
You must spice your food or pepper your food with everything you eat. I mean, let's face it, that works until you hit the ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it's just not so yummy.
Now, I've actually read her stuff, and she, when she goes through these little, like, things that, like, she wants them to not do for one reason or not, there is a clear line of, and it's something that at least the people that I see that you know, are subscribing to this particular bridge of Christianity don't really get, which is that she's really talking about, in a lot of ways, leaning towards living as basically lean a life as possible and actually having as little comforts as possible. Okay, which actually in and of itself is sort of, you know, could actually lead to, you know, at least, you know, that's how she lived. You know, it's how all they lived. And it definitely had a purpose for them. You know, so it's kind of, you know, at least for me, I sort of get the deeper meaning of why she put that in there. But she's also, I'm being really serious. Like, I actually went in depth to the whole Seventh-day Adventism thing just to understand what was wrong with my in-laws. I mean, and, like, I'm being really serious because, like, I started talking to them about, like, theology one day, and, like, they started saying stuff, and they said that Jesus was the Archangel Michael, and I was like, what? So when I've read all the books and stuff, so I do get it from sort of that level, is that, like, I sat and read all of it to figure out, like, what the hell was going on. And no, the person that started it, Ellen White, she's out there. I mean, like, she's crazy. I mean, like, definitely, like, you know, her descriptions of how she, like, talked to the, you know, Jesus and all that stuff. Like, no, like, she clearly had, like, some kind of, like, mental breakdown is sort of the result of it. But, you know, I do also have this, you know, thing of, well, if you actually think that she was, you know, all that you said she was, you know, you need to understand that there's this leanness within it for a reason, because you're sort of supposed to be aligning yourself with the way Christ was. It's her whole deal, basically.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. So, in a nutshell, that's pretty much everything that I had written down to bring to the table tonight, and it carried us pretty well through most of the show, so I'm happy about that. But I was just kind of curious as to why you think that this trend among people that are respectable, I mean, these are people that are philosophically very strong, yet they still seem to take this very pragmatic vantage where you should abandon everything that's esoteric in favor of real life experience. Why do you think that this kind of thing evolves?
I honestly, at least for me, I find it to be a denial of what you're talking about, the emotional center, is that for some reason, and like I was actually going to bring that up earlier, but you went sort of past it, but there seems to be a denial of any spiritual element, or like I've read posts from people saying that like we should learn to overcome emotion, you know, stuff like that. And I see this kind of denial of sort of the emotional, imaginative, and in a lot of ways, in my personal opinion, creative side of humanity that's sort of running around, especially throughout, you know, the philosophical places that we sort of play in. And I do see that that's, I see on one level why people are doing it, which is because I think that's where a lot of the superstition that people are trying to get away with comes from. But at the same time, I really do feel that has to have a purpose within humanity as a whole, or it wouldn't have been there to begin with.
Right. Well, I mean, in my eyes, it becomes pretty obvious that the reason that we have these fantastic ideas like mysticism or supernatural or whatever are because we seek to explain things in systems, and when there is no obvious system, we put one in place to kind of just act as a bookmarker. Until some more information comes up about it, and we're able to continue reading further. So that's why I think that kind of thing happens. And when it happens, it generally tends to store whatever practical knowledge is actually available at that point in time within it. So you have this, this wonderful mythos of this dude sitting on top of Mount Olympus, and he throws lightning bolts down, and you know, he looks at this big theater game chessboard type thing and moves these little people along, and he sets up all the dominoes, and And the wind blows and starts to chain him, knocking him over, and he chuckles and, you know, he sets them all up again and goes at it again. But what we're learning through this process is we're learning that life inevitably always seems to bear results. And those results, when you take a look back, are pretty much clearly defined as, oh, well, it turned out this way because this happened, and that led to this, and then this happened, and then this over here happened, and even though we had no idea this was happening over here, it played in here. And so we see how the thing arose that we'd experienced by accident. And I think that in itself kind of mirrors what you're talking about.
Well, and, you know, I would also say, too, that a lot of the superstitious beliefs were attempts to explain things that we know how they occurred. Like, you know, using Zeus for an example. I mean, like, besides really representing their government as sort of an icon, beyond that, I mean, it's very, very clear that, you know, like, and that's something that I think, too, is that, like, If we don't know how it works or why it works, we're going to imaginatively figure out how it works. And I think that's where a lot of the sort of superstitious ideas come from, is because we didn't know what caused rain, you know, or what the lightning and thunder meant. So we created an entire thing when today, you know, the weather guy gets up and tells you, you know, what's going to happen for the next week.
Right on, and he's oftentimes very wrong, but we'll leave that little bit out there. So what you're saying is you agree with me that mythology and that sort of thing arises as us trying to give an explanation for a phenomenon that we're not familiar with. Not that it's somehow supernatural or beyond our ability to understand, but that we just do not have the familiarity. So we need to make up some kind of a reason as a placeholder.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. And I think that, you know, you see little kids do it. Like, you know, you have a son, you know what I'm talking about. Like, sometimes their explanations for why things happen, you know, reflects this sort of better than, you know, anything else. Like, I had my son got... This is what happened. He got sick, and he threw up in the laundromat. And then he says to me, well, I got sick because I ate that trail mix, because I don't like it. And I said, no, you do like it, and it didn't cause it. And he said, yeah, it did, because I ate it, and then I threw up. So, like, and you can see it right there. We're like, he's connecting two things in his mind that really aren't connected at all. But to him, he argued with me for a good 15 minutes about this, too, where, like, these two things have to be connected because this happened, then this happened. And logically speaking, that works, except he's missing, you know, some fundamental pieces of the information that he simply doesn't understand because of his age.
Right. And that's exactly it. That's exactly what we have to kind of take a look at on a whole. And we have to kind of say that these things kind of developed because we didn't understand them at our age. It wasn't that we had a stomach virus that we knew nothing about. It was that we ate these nuts and we got sick, and therefore, every time we eat these nuts, we're going to get sick. And that's the same kind of thing that arises. You know, we had a string of bad luck, and, you know, we heard some lightning crashing, and that was Zeus laughing at us.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And the thing, too, is that the human mind is such a funny thing, too, which is that, like, if you really trick yourself into believing that those nuts made you sick, you could, you know, and this happens all the time, which is that, like, you know, people will actually manifest that psychological thing that they believe, even though, like, yeah, and you know what I'm talking about. I think it's called, like, psychosomatic something or another. But, yeah, it's like where, like, you believe something caused something, so it winds up becoming that. My sister had that with a meatloaf, actually, when she was a kid, because she had pink eye, and her she had pink eye, and my mom was going to take her to the doctor literally the next day. But we were sitting down to eat dinner. Chrissy took a bite of the meatloaf, and when she did, the blood vessels in her eyes started popping. Yeah. So her eyes started bleeding. Well, she was young, so, she wouldn't eat meatloaf because it made her eye bleed, is what she would say. And, I remember it was a good 3 or 4 years, after that. My mom was like, no, you're going to eat it. And she, she basically, came in and had that ogre mom moment where, no, you're going to do this, and I'm going to prove you that it's wrong. But Chrissy's eyes swelled shut after she was forced to eat it. Yeah. And the doctor, my mom took her to the doctor, and she was explaining to her, and the doctor was like, that's psychosomatic. She really believes that meatloaf is going to hurt her eyes. So that's what happened.
Right on. So the lesson there in that, folks, for those of you that are listening, is that meatloaf makes your eyes bleed. And you should no longer eat meatloaf.
Yeah. Yeah, that's no, it's and it's a very funny thing, I think, is that, there is superstition seeped in it, but there's definitely something to that side of us, I think that we do it with everything. We have to have that placeholder to sort of define stuff that we don't understand, and there's still so much that we don't understand yet.
Right on. So I think we got, hang on a minute. We've got roughly about eight minutes left in the show, and I kind of wanted to address, Lehi had asked me in an email what was the deal with this coming Saturday show, and since I made mention this past Sunday that I didn't really know what was going on, and I would have a firmer grasp by tonight's show, I suppose that I should kind of lay out that this Saturday night there will be another show. That show will air sometime, I'm assuming, around 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If, for whatever reason, it doesn't hit the air right then and there, it may get pushed a little further back. Or it might not happen at all. I'm really not certain still about how my weekend's going to go through, but I know for sure every other Saturday we're going to still have our normal 1 o'clock deal. It's just during the opposite weekend that I have my son. I have full availability for my new mentor / boss, whatever you want to call him, who has really been a great guy. I mean, a fantastic guy. He's already taught me quite a bit and has already helped me out quite a bit. He's gave me a few opportunities to make some money this week when I was really hurt and needed to be able to put things together. So, that should be that. And then the topic, I think, will be more about us discussing the fate of the Primus Mano show than anything else on Saturday night's show. We might get into some other kind of, some other kind of esoteric or philosophical application while we're in the discussion. But the main point of it is going to be what both of us hope to achieve with that particular episode and how we're going to navigate it from there. Maybe listening to all the horse gallop in the background, is that? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I was listening.
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah. I think my phone just went on stupid for a minute, so.
Oh. Yeah, no, I was just listening to what y'all were talking about. You were talking about Saturday's show. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's the deal for this coming Saturday show. We'll you know, we'll work it, all the rest of the details out. But, yeah, I think that's definitely what I plan to do. And quite honestly, I'm jabber-jawed out at this point. So if you have anything you wanted to discuss, we still have, I believe, 4 minutes left in the show.
Yeah, I was going to say that I want to, I need to shoot Rotten off an email and find out what to do about Friday's show, because Oregon Wicked are out. But honestly, I'm afraid that I don't know how long they're going to be out, and I'm worried that, you know, taking, you know, like, I don't know if it's 4 weeks, you know, it's like a month that the show doesn't air, and I'm afraid that it's actually going to wind up hurting listeners in the long run. So I need to get with Rotten and figure out if he wants to, you know, keep it going without them, or what we can do about Friday's show.
Yeah, that would be a good idea. The other thing to keep in mind is that something that's been successful for TV for years and years and years is seasons. So if, you know, it looks like you're going to need to do a long pause, you might, you know, create some kind of season finale that leaves them hanging for the next time that the Friday edition comes along again.
Yeah, yeah, and that's an option too. And and the other thing is that, you know, there's four of us call into that, and not everybody makes it every week, which is part of why there's four there, is because, you know, somebody might have something else going on, so you might have at least, you know, two or three call in, is sort of how it's worked out. So the other thing is that Rotten hasn't actually been there the past few weeks we had a show, so I'm worried that maybe his availability's changed, and I don't know that yet.
Right on. So, well, you still got a couple of days, and nothing's actually technically scheduled up at this point, so,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't stress yourself out too much trying to figure it out. Just, as my new mentor would say, just take your time and let it happen.
Yeah. I know, exactly. That's what I've been doing with pretty much everything lately, is, you know, trying to be a little less, I don't know, type A about, I don't know, the world in general.
Right on. Well, apparently we've got 90 seconds, according to the BTR bitch here. So with all that being said and done, I think next week we'll get into some other philosophical ramble.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Yeah, that'll
have
work.
A good evening.
You too.
All right.